Today on ABCDTOS, Alon of Troyes.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to ABCDTOS. It's that Star Trek podcast where we go alphabetically through all the episodes of the original series, from All Our Yesterdays to Wolf in the Fold.
Double Yay!
I'm Pete the Retailer.
I'm Tom Taylor.
I'm John Engel.
And I'm Joe Mazel.
And today we are talking about Alon of Troyes. Alon of Troyes, which is, I did not open my notebook, but it's the second episode to be produced in the third season, but the 13th episode to air. Like the Corbomite maneuver before it, they filmed it early, and then they're like, oh, wait, we got a lot of effects to take care of here. So they... I guess they do, don't they? Yeah, it ended up airing. They actually, some of the effects shots that they completed for this, they ended up using in other episodes that aired before it, before this one did. So they're like, all right, we finally got that Klingon done. All right, well, actually, we need to use that for this episode, so hang on to that.
I'd be really curious to see if the remastered versions use the same shots between episodes. That'd be really funny.
Interesting.
This does explain why Bill Shatner isn't quite as shaggy as he is in the surrounding episodes.
Zoinks.
I noticed that too, actually. Season three is supposed to be real shaggy on Shatner. And,
I mean,
yeah,
and the children shall lead. He's got hair down to his butt, practically.
You know, he had hair down to his goddamn shoulders. Just trim it a little. Somebody who does, we do get a good close-up of their hair is Scotty, right? Pretty much right off the bat.
Yeah.
We get like tight zoom on Scotty's hairline, which is like, oh, okay. He's like, welcome to my season three look.
Yeah. This isn't your daddy's season two Star Trek Scotty haircut. I don't know.
We also we get a wonderful shot from a reverse shot of Chekhov, who apparently in real life was 50 pounds thinner and had tight red hair.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Did you guys notice that?
I did.
Used an old stock footage shot. Yeah.
No, I didn't.
Oh,
that's
wow.
Interesting.
It's weird because at the time, it's a very specific position, like Kirk standing behind Sulu. So you're like, okay, this was shot for the episode. Oh, no, this was not shot for this episode. That guy's not Chekhov sitting there.
Now, did
there's also the shot.
Oh, God, I completely. Oh, maybe they fixed it.
Do you think they fixed it?
No, I was watching the remaster too.
And yeah, I was watching the remaster.
Well, we could get into what, how connected, how engaged in this episode I was for certain chunks of it, I guess.
Also reused the Sulu turns around to look at his captain shot.
Right. Well, that's a common one, right? Didn't they use that a lot?
Yeah, they used that a lot, and it does not match in any episode.
Yeah. Well, didn't he turn around at one point when nobody was in the chair? I think there was one point where he turned around. Like, he kept turning around, and then he turned around, and nobody was actually in the chair at the moment. But he was turned around, looking at as if Kirk was in the chair.
He was just looking at the camera. Can you believe this? You get to be on TV.
It was a real Billy Ray Valentine moment.
So, Pete, I'm completely detached from the show. What's this episode about?
Yeah, so I was going to say, let me break it down a little bit. This is not where I beatbox.
That's where I beatbox. Go.
Alon of Troyes, a rebellious warrior princess, causes mayhem on the Enterprise, but her real power lies in her tears.
Aww.
With Captain Kirk helplessly in love with her and a Klingon warship in their path, Mr. Spock and Dr. McCoy seek desperate remedies.
Desperate
remedies.
Hey, guys,
is something weird about this episode right off the bat?
Uh-huh.
This is in a weird club of episodes for me that I went decades without seeing this episode. I saw this for the first time... You know, 20 or 30 years into my Star Trek fandom.
I never saw
three or four episodes like that.
Until I finally bought that third, 15 years ago, whatever. I finally bought that red box, the third season. And that was the first time I'd ever seen this episode. And I don't believe I have seen it since. I think this was the second time I've seen this episode.
Yeah, I saw it a long time ago. And, but I love that I was marveling at the scope of this project. I was like, oh, good. Like, we get to go back and like these ones that I know of that I saw, forever ago on PBS or whatever once. And I know of, more so from, ancillary books, source books and stuff like that. And, we're going to go refamiliarize myself with those. I'm like, I'm glad we're doing this. You know, I'm glad we get to watch Star Trek and talk to you guys about it.
Now I'm glad about this whole thing.
Yeah.
Did you guys, I have to, because I first saw it and the other holes in my Star Trek experience, there was the Sci-Fi Channel in like 97 or 98.
They did like the unedited ones with the Nimoy.
Yeah, and that's interesting. They did the entire series with Shatner as a sort of Alistair Cook sort of host of the thing. And they would like at commercial breaks, they would like interview people and do behind the scenes stuff and things. So each episode was like 2 hours long and it was really cool. And I videotaped every single one and then threw them away 20 years later because who needs these? But yeah, then they did the whole thing with Leonard Nimoy. I know. Yeah. Sorry, everybody out there. I could have given those two. But yeah, that was a cool thing. And that was, my introduction to this and a couple other episodes.
I feel like it saves itself from being lumped in with a lot of other episodes. I feel like there's a whole pool of episodes and I'm like, which one is that? This must be some other thing. But like because it's named after her and she is kind of so striking, it's easy to be like, oh yeah, the one with her.
Yeah.
Yep. You know what I mean?
I mean, the episode actually could have easily been titled The One with Alon of Troyes. They could have used the Friends naming system.
Well, you know what I think? I had a real hard time with this episode for about the first 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, I'm just noticing how I'm spending all my time noticing how ridiculous the costuming is, which usually isn't that big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Don't even want to get into like having holsters in the crook of your elbow. Like, what the hell is that?
Don't criticize other people's culture.
Yeah.
That's just like tactically horrible
just
idea.
Because you don't understand doesn't mean you don't criticize.
Right. Not being able to bend your arm. Great for action. Anyway.
I just shot myself.
I had to go back and watch that initial turbo lift scene again. Because I was like, the stakes here, just something's up. I can't get a grip on the stakes of this story. And I realized it's because for whatever reason, they decide to set it up as not being a big deal. Nothing's a big deal here. He complains. Right. He complains about those bureaucrats putting us on this stupid mission. What's the secrecy about? I don't know. Some Klingons kind of want some territory. Maybe. I don't know why they would, though. And I'm like, why would you do that? Like, some of the best, a lot of the best at Star Trek episodes start with, boom, we're right in the middle of something heavy. We know exactly why this is a problem. We know this is going to be a problem to solve. And instead, they create this kind of nebulous stakes. And I'm even like, I don't really still even understand what the big deal was.
Right. I mean, even they've had a few missions where, we're ambassadors of the universe and we're, these people are in the Federation and we need to, facilitate this thing going on. And they treat it like it's a big deal. Like it's an important role of, Starfleet to handle these things. But here, they're kind of like, oh, geez. Oh, my God.
I'm
falling asleep.
Yeah, it's a little bit it's a little bit of too much, like a little bit of grave. Like the Klingons, I feel like, add a little bit too much to it that it's like, all right, you should have established that again, like John said, just jump right into it. If you're going to have the Klingon thing in there, it seems, I know you need a time lock and a problem to solve, you need a little action bit. So it's not just strictly,
Taming of the Shrew.
Yeah. The Taming of the Shrew. But, there could have been a different thing. I thought maybe it was going to be somebody from, their planet or some other person interfering in it rather than the Klingons interfering. It did seem kind of out of place to me.
Well, I think the solution simply is have our characters care about it. They really didn't have to change anything. They just have to make, this is really important. We got to get these, we got to get her to this point. We got to get these systems agreeing and we got to make sure the Klingons don't get a hold of this situation, the hold of this territory.
Well,
just make it seem important. They go out of their way to make it seem unimportant and also that they don't really know what's going on. And then when the stakes are actually expressed by Petrie, it's really kind of bland because like, hey, we both have nuclear missiles aimed at each other. So we got to figure this out. It's like, well, that's the exact situation the United States was in at the time. It's not, we're not all like freaking out and running around the house. It's just mutually assured destruction is not like a we better do something right now about it kind of situation. It's actually the opposite. So I would
do nothing. Don't upset the apple cart.
Then we find out that's why, they're not being told anything other than what they need to know because the higher ups are in control. And that creates then this parallel between Elan and Kirk, that they're both just kind of pawns in this a little bit, but they're both like, all right, well, I got to do what I got to do. And then we find out through this whole, you know, through the course of the show, we find out why both parties are in it. The Federation absolutely knows that they're like, oh yeah, these common dirty rocks that are all over the place. They know that that's, you know, they're absolutely making a play. It's all about oil, essentially. and they know what they're doing, but it's, you know, we see that these, both of our characters are kind of pawns in this whole play, essentially.
Yeah. Oh, so you think the Federation knew about the Dilithium crystals? Oh, really? Okay.
I think so.
Interesting.
Well, I mean, I read it as basically that the Federation are doing this out of complete benevolence, and they can't figure out why the Klingons are into them, and it's a reveal that there's a resource involved.
Yeah,
Kirk was getting the dark.
Joe.
Yeah, no, I mean, and you're right. I know that seems, and I don't mean to needle Tom with this, that seems more Kelvin-y in execution. Mm. That the I feel that the 60s Federation, you know, wasn't really hiding secrets. But it wasn't really creating secrets.
Yeah, I don't know why they get Kirk out of that loop.
They make a point of it at the beginning of saying, like, yeah, we're not being told much about this other than we have to do
okay.
it.
Oh,
fair enough.
If they hadn't introduced that, then I would have been like, oh, that's funny. But like the fact they introduced that and then kind of pay it off, and it ties in with her basically saying the same thing. She's like, hey, we're... Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to do, you know, honor and duty or whatever, and, you know.
Duty.
See, all of this is true, and yet it doesn't fix anything about that first 20 minutes being a snooze. I mean, it's just right. like, what is, you know, and the way, the pacing of it, Petri is like, Kirk, this is very important. You must be kind. You must behave this way. And the very next scene, he's like, I can't handle this. It's like, what the hell? Like, can I get at least one beat of him being competent in what he's, his mission is? That would have helped me a little bit. It just, everything felt a little slapdash. I felt like when the main characters don't care, I'll trade all the things that you guys are saying. They're all true. Trade all of them to make the characters more engaging. We got 50 minutes here. We don't have time for this. I mean, two commercial breaks and I'm out, man. Make sure I understand why I care about this episode is all I'm asking.
You know, everything you say, John, is correct. And I couldn't disagree more. I find it so over the top and campy and so, you know, ridiculous costumes and ridiculous makeup and this weirdly flamboyant Petri guy, it's just sort of like, I find the first 20 minutes to be an absurdist delight.
That's fun, but that can't.
And again, you're not
very
wrong.
Far. For me, I just need more. You get that in every Star Trek episode. I want more. I want to be engaged in the story too. Or I'm not. I mean, don't get me wrong. I like the episode. Okay, like once the Klingons show up, once I start kind of getting the plot. Okay, we're getting plot. We're getting stakes raised here. I'm on board from then on. But we're comparing Star Trek episodes to Star Trek episodes on this show. I'm saying they could have done a better job. They could have had all that you are saying.
Get you guys to regretting your A-minus on Doomsday Machines right about now.
See, that's funny because I'm like, yeah, the Klingons were extra. We didn't really need them in it.
Right.
Where I think that's like, hey, that's, you know, like, get me more, you know, give me more of Petri. And I want that whole, like, you know, I kind of want it to just to be purely, you know, space taming of the shrew.
Yeah, I agree with you. Don't get me wrong. I agree with you. But when the Klingon ship shows up, I at least know where I'm at. That's what I'm saying. Well, there's a Klingon. Now there's something happening. I'm not saying that was the best choice. I'm just saying I understand this. Now I know there's an imminent threat. I just didn't feel like there was anything imminent about anything happening before. And it was all just kind of. And I like Space Taming of the Shrew, too. If they could have just stuck to that. Why did they not commit to. I feel like if it wasn't Fred Freiberger, they would have been more committed to the Shakespearean element of this.
That was
one and two, maybe.
She was the weirdest part of this episode for me. Because once, we're not going through this as chronologically as we could. But when the big thing happens, she gets her tears on him. And they both fall hopelessly. I was completely, just what I was about to say, I don't know if it was accurate, that they fall completely in love with each other. Is she in love with him? Was she trapping him with her tears? Did that sincerely happen, that she was sad because nobody likes me? And so she started crying and then he touched her. Like, Was she in control of that, or was she a victim of that? Like, I actually don't know to this day exactly what happened with her, like what her story was.
That's why it's good, because there are layers. She is both. She might not be, you know, she's not two-dimensional. She is like partially she's doing it to get what she wants, but then also she's kind of, she does kind of find him attractive and, you know, not just physically attractive, but she's attracted to the idea of him, his, you know, that he stood up to her a little bit and was, and also she is like, hey, really nobody likes me, but she's using it. At first she's using it, but there's truth to her using it too. You know, it's not completely.
Yeah.
I think this is the classic, somebody was undercover, but they fell in love with the mark, you know, like it's classic. I think she was absolutely trying to dupe him at the beginning. I think they make it very clear. They cut, once he touches the tears, there's a music cue. Then they cut to a close up of her eyes and she looks up at him in a real menacing way. I think they're telling us, trying to trap him here, but I think she falls in love with him because he's Kirk.
Yeah.
Of course she does.
Yeah.
So it's one of those, if Kirk finds out that she didn't mean it, she's like, but you don't understand, it started that way, but I did fall in love with you. You know, we've seen that.
I think I needed like more sinister looks and more of that speech of like, you know, oh no, it started off as a thing, but now I really love you. I think I needed some of that because I was very confused the whole time. Like I went along with it. I had a fine time, but I was waiting for someone to tell me what was going on. I watched my kids' TV show.
There is a great deal of ambiguity there because she is very unlikable. So she could have legitimately been crying, and it's never really quite established how much the, what is the name of Alan's planet, what is her race?
Troyes.
Troyes is where she's going.
Hers is
she's right. The
Troyes is where she's going.
Yeah, Troyes is where she's going.
And oh, it's Elos or
Elysian. Right?
It's a Elos.
Elysian.
But like, how aware are the Elysians of their love powers of themselves? Since it's all part of their culture.
Oh, completely.
But I mean, like, how aware are they? How aware are they of the moral issues involved in basically drugging people they love, or drugging people for to have them fall in love with them, as opposed to, say, the Troyans, who clearly realize there's, you know, it's kind of screwy the way these people deal with their own emotions and their courting.
Right.
Well, yeah, I think she's fully aware. I think it's a big part of her character arc, which I think she has a strong character arc.
Yeah.
And part of that is based on one thing that I'll ask you guys now. It has to do with the end. She's wearing the wedding dress, right, at the end? Remember, because he offers her that and she's like, get that out of here. And then we see her, she's starting to become pretty contrite and she's wearing one thing. And then the next time we see her, she's suddenly in that blue dress. And it made me think, I think she's fully come around at this point. I think she really is in love with Kirk. And she's sort of wearing this wedding gown as a way of saying, I'm fully committed.
Married.
Yeah. Well, at least fully. I'm fully committed to my love to you, Kirk.
Well, because she does a little bit is like this because she thinks they're going to die and the ruse didn't work. And so she's kind of given up a little bit, but also then at the same time is falling in love with Kirk. So I don't know. It's not black and white clear cut, which I find kind of refreshing in this. Normally that's what I like about Star Trek is that it's black and white clear cut.
See, you're hearing it as ambiguous and I'm hearing it as just kind of muddled. I don't know.
I'm calling it subtle.
Subtle. Okay.
Yeah.
Joe, what
there is also there is also the possibility, and I'm just looking at the one line of dialogue that I decided to write down, and it's not the one you think. There is the possibility that like you can emit your love tears only when you actually have the emotion. Like it's not, you know, it's not something you necessarily can use for manipulation. Maybe you can. It's, you know, again, it's your reading on the episode, which is sort of delightful that we're able to have this conversation, you know, debate this on some level. But it's, I don't know. So one of the worst lines of dialogue I've heard in anything lately is, you cannot resist my love,
Yeah.
There's an echo in here.
Yeah. But sounds better in the original Elysian.
Yeah. Yeah, right. But you can read into that that she actually has developed feelings for him. And that is why she's able to cry tears for him. As opposed to just manipulating the captain. Right. And it's very possible she's manipulating him. Don't get me wrong.
I really, really think she manipulated the tears. I mean, I feel very strongly about that. Because I think they hang a lantern right on it.
It is a little bit. But there's truth to it. But
it's weird. Her acting
is
sad.
But there's truth to it.
Hey, the best con men tell the truth to you, right? Like
her sad acting seems really sincere. Like, oh, people don't like me. Why don't they like me? But I would expect from a 60s TV show if there were fakiness to it, for that to be telegraphed more.
Right.
And I think maybe that's part of what confused
me. I think if you watched it again, you'd realize it was telegraphed pretty heavily.
You guys keep talking. I'm going to watch the episode again.
He puts his finger up to her face and it goes like, da-da-da-da. And then she looks up, her eyes kind of like glide up and she clearly looks like, got him.
Well,
I swear it's clear as day.
But it's not like she doesn't be like, aha, I got you. She's just like, oh, well, now, like, she knows that now it's in, you know, there's more than one emotion there. Because I think it is, well, now I got him, but also, like, this is, so I got him.
Now will he
like me? I got what I want is kind of the, is I got what I want part of the undertone, or is it I got what I need part of the undertone? And that's the basic kind of question. And John, you're fully on the got what I need spectrum.
Well, I mean, all of it's good. I mean, I just think she did it. Her intentionality here is clear to me. What happens from it is what makes it interesting and why I think she's easily the best thing in this episode to me. Like her arc and her performance and everything about her, like we've said before, maybe it would have been a better episode if they just stuck with that and fleshed that out more. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, to me, like the fact that she has this, underlying motives at the beginning, that in classic Star Trek fashion, of course she's going to fall in love with Kirk. It's Kirk. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that then it would bring out this real love in her because it's James Kirk. So by the end of it, she's changed. And I think it's good. It's good, solid character and story. As for the rest of the episode, like we talked about, we could talk about whether that's good story or not. I don't know. the basic plot of what's going on, the cloak and dagger of it, maybe isn't so great. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
That's just there for although I do like that there's literally a dagger.
There is there's multiple daggers.
Needed more coke, I guess.
Given, thrown at people, stabbed in people, given to people.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the three.
Yes, that's the three
the
uses
three
of the dagger.
Three phases of the dagger.
Yes.
Which is
now let's talk about the phases of the cloak.
Yeah. All right. So we start out, they're talking about the assignment before we meet our aliens. They're talking about the assignment that we get the close up on Scotty's new hair. We get a good when they establish the kind of not the goalposts, but they're like they give us this exposition where Spock is like, oh yeah, Elysians are jerks. Scientifically, they're assholes. But
measurably.
And then McCoy is just like, well, that's not all, though. But the women are beautiful and their tears will make you. I don't think he doesn't say the tear part. That threw me because later I was like, wait, doesn't he know Kirk? No, but he wasn't there for that conversation. That's later in Sick Bay.
Yes, he was there for that conversation.
He was
there.
Oh, yeah. He was.
I was definitely going to bring up that part. There's no reason for him to touch her face. That's from a plot point. That moment is actually horrible. I like the character and thematic things happening there.
Which is
we should have known about those tears. He was right next to her. With him and he explained it.
Well, so all right, so here's what we need to fix for this episode. We need to go put Chekhov back where Chekhov belongs.
Right.
We need to figure out what
does
Sulu's
Chekhov
looking
belong?
At. And we also need to get Kirk out of that scene so he doesn't know about the tears.
And it was easy. All you had to do, he went to talk to Uhura.
Right.
Just have say Uhura come with me.
Right.
Boom. Yeah. Fixed scene. I don't know what they were thinking there. I feel like that was one of those rushed, we forgot to get Kirk out of the room. Yeah.
I do like that we get to see Uhura's quarters.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird that she gave them up. That's weird. They're like, I'm surprised the Enterprise doesn't have like an ambassador suite or something.
That's more for your B, C, and D enterprises, I think.
I guess this one.
This one doesn't have that stuff, but yeah, Uhura, of course she's going. She's gracious. She's great. But the part, he does this a lot, Kirk. She's immediately like, I gave up my course. Oh, yeah, we appreciate that.
We know.
He does a lot of interrupting people.
Yeah.
Like, granted, I don't understand.
He is trying to sidestep her getting like, she's like, no, we're not upset with you, is basically what he's saying. But he does like,
right.
let her finish
if you're going to,
you've had your
gonna
half
soothe
line.
Her, let her finish her sentence first.
Yeah.
But yeah, so when McCoy is talking about how
ew, Captain, what did you do on my bed?
Yeesh,
yeah.
Right. They should have when the door opens and McCoy later. This is later, of course. When the door opens and Spock and McCoy are there, and they're like, Captain, we need to talk to you. They should have been there too. And be like, oh, come on.
Wow.
They walk off and she calls housekeeping.
Right. Yeah.
I'm gonna need a change of sheets here.
There's a good kind of double up on when McCoy is just like, women are beautiful and they can, you know, enslave you with their tears. And then Spock, you know, gives a little eyebrow raise. And then Kirk follows up with like eye roll. He's like, yeah, well, you know, you know how he is. Like,
I've seen them all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then we meet our aliens. And first we get the guards, her personal guard show up.
Yeah.
Those
guys are nerds.
Wearing placemats, which I was like, oh, I remember that kind of that yeah. motif, that style of thing. My grandparents, I think, had that in their condo in Boca.
Yeah. exactly.
Those like plastic kind of, and they make it into like a fire, like a phoenix kind of thing, but it's basically just a bunch of placemats stapled together.
Yeah.
And my first thought was like, total, God, that's uncomfortable.
They look like absolute knockoff, like space alien man action figure.
Yeah,
it's like not tied to anything or something.
Yeah,
in the 70s.
Space battler.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I got the space battler, and hair.
They pull phasers immediately upon, and then everybody just like stands there. Like,
yeah,
hey, those guys just pulled weapons. Like aborting your ship. Shouldn't you respond to that in some way? That's very weird to me. I because like I said, like many of us hadn't seen this episode very much or recently, and I was like, oh, they're taking over the ship right away, and I was like, wait, nothing's happening.
No,
you pull a phaser, you better be ready to shoot it, man.
They didn't follow through.
Yeah.
I will. So we get the party of three guards. The main one's name is Crichton, which I kept expecting to be a British android.
He was going to write a book about a dinosaur amusement park.
But. Yeah. and then the other two are unnamed, but one of them is played by Charles Beck, who this is his only acting credit ever, apparently.
Wow.
He did this and he's like, yeah, you know what? I'm good.
I've achieved my goal.
But the other guard is played by Dick Durock, who's Swamp Thing himself.
Oh, wow.
So that made me happy. I was like, oh, good, it's Swamp Thing. how many times has somebody said that to you? Crichton is played by Tony Young, who is in a bunch of stuff. And
as the tall guy.
Yeah, basically. in a bunch of, you know, he was in Charo, the musical.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Hoochie Coochie.
Hoochie Coochie.
Taggart.
Wait, Charo the musical or Charo the Elvis movie?
He is the musical western, 1969, co-starring Elvis. Yeah.
Yeah, Charles doesn't really have that much music in it. We're going on a whole nother thing. Never mind.
Married to Madeline Rue, who played MacGyver's in Space Seed. So we'll meet her again.
I remember I looked at his credits too and thought, I think this guy spent a lot of time at Spawn Movie Ranch before he took it over. He just seemed like he was on all those shows that would have been shot out there.
Yeah.
Right.
My notes kind of got sparse a little bit here because I roped into like, okay, what's going on?
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah, they beam aboard, and then we get this I wrote racy camera tilts because it's like, okay, it's safe. Let's bring aboard what's her title again? It's
the Dolman.
The Dolman, which the Dolman. I can't the find Dolman. Any. The only definition I could find for that word was that it's some kind of an Indian shirt or blouse or Turkish. Sorry, it was Turkish. I was like, surely they're using this word in a. Nope, they just made it up. She's the Dolman.
Huh.
Yeah, well, she's certainly not wearing a shirt.
Yeah, that, exactly. Ironic, I guess. They were like, hey, let's name her after a shirt and then never put one on her.
I was surprised. I mean, I guess it's, you know, third season. They know what they can. They're like, what are they going to do? Cancel us? But I was surprised, you know, how tame they had to be and how this got. Kind of like, because as they kind of started her legs and move up her body, and I was like, okay.
I was kind of surprised they didn't play the sexy Star Trek saxophone theme.
Yeah, that's just the stripper.
There's a good Spock moment too, like right before she beams in, the guards all kneel down and like, you must pay honor to the Dolman, and then Petri kneels. And then the Enterprise crew does not.
Right.
And then Spock goes so far as to cross his arms in the Spock fashion. I thought that was really great. It's like, prayer. I am definitely not kneeling. Of course, once they saw her, they're like, oh, yeah, I'll kneel. Why not?
I'll kneel. Sure.
Hey.
You said kneel. Yeah. No, I'll do that. Yeah.
Anything for a lady.
So then we get the whole crux of it that they're all right, the two they're ferrying these two over, and Petrie's there to kind of train her in the ways of Troyes while kind of getting her ready for this wedding thing, and she's having none of it. She does have, I don't know how far into it because it totally picks up, my notes pick up again once the Klingons show up, but there's a bit where it's like, you know, she's complaining about, you know, he's like, oh, you're gonna sit there and you know, you're gonna get married and learn all these customs, and she's like, I will not, like, if I have to stay here for 10 light years, I will, like, I about, you know, she's throwing a tantrum, and she's like, I'm not gonna do it if I have to stay. I think when she locks herself in the what could be a bathroom, but we don't know.
Right. That they won't tell us.
Right.
That'd be too crude.
She says something about if I stay over 10 light years, and I was like, is that wrong? It is, like, they are traveling, so it's like, well, if I have to stay here for, you know, 10 miles. Right. I was like, yeah, I guess. Yeah.
One question just occurs to me. Don't they say that she's the leader? Do they not say the Dolman is the leader of Elos? I think they say that. Who is making her do this?
Let's see.
It's a good question.
It's a royal title of great privilege and prerogative. However, it did have to answer to the Elysian Council of Nobles.
So the Council of Nobles sent her on this.
Stupid nobles.
She has no choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an arranged marriage. Gotcha. Marriage.
Now, John, is there something you would like to say about the actress who plays Elan of Troyes?
Are we talking about France Nguyen?
Yes.
Yeah. Was she on Columbo?
She was. Yeah.
I did not find that credit. How did I looked miss it up.
I didn't find William Wyndham last time, and now you didn't find her.
Well, I looked on IMDb, and it didn't
Murder
show me
Under Glass. I didn't look up who she was.
Is that the Louis Jordan one?
Is that the one with Danny Thomas?
That's the one with
only big fans of the Gilbert Gottfried podcast. We'll understand that joke.
It's, yeah. No,
or Frank Danny Thomas' is in that
one, and I'm assuming she's one of the other restaurateurs who is not murdered by Louis Jordan.
Okay. Wow. She's great. I actually really
and
like her.
In Battle of the Planet of the Apes.
Right.
Hey. Nice.
Obviously, they're her greatest credit.
Yeah.
And she was also, we'll get to that. So she's French and Vietnamese, which combination that makes sense. She starred on Broadway in the World of Susie Wong with William Shatner.
Hey.
So they had already been acquainted.
Wait, on Broadway or on stage?
Broadway. I read it as on Broadway.
Or in my garage.
Yeah. Broadway in Montreal. No, it said Broadway, so I don't know. I'll have to double research that, but I'm not going to do it right now.
I would like to take that at face value. Just accept it.
And so she, here's the whole thing. I read a lot about the, not a lot, a lot, but I read about the kind of potential, the projected or the perceived cultural stereotyping here. Yeah, mm-hmm. Which I did not pick up on because I did not, to me, she did not read as Asian at all.
No,
she read
yeah.
as kind of like, you know, ancient Greek, because, you know, it's like Helen of Troy kind of a thing, kind of ancient Greek combined with alien, combined with, you know, just like
a little bit of Egyptian thrown in there. And
yeah. Yeah. I was thinking like actual authentic Cleopatra, like what, yeah. Not Elizabeth Taylor sure. Cleopatra, but the real Cleopatra.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's totally yeah. like, she read more like that to me than Asian at all. And only afterwards I read, like, oh, she's French Vietnamese and played a lot of, you know, like played Susie Wong and a lot of other stuff. She certainly leaned into her Asian heritage in other roles. But then people using that were just like, well, this is very much like, this episode plays on a lot of Asian stereotypes of the kind of like the dragon lady, you know, kind of mm-hmm. Cruel, you know, well, the word I can't find, but that kind of, you know, the woman who's impossible to please, but then also then clicks and turns into the like another Asian stereotype of the kind of submissive slave girl.
Oh, wow.
Where she's just like, you know, like, I just want to be near you. You know, like, I want to die next to you. And like, none, you know, mm-hmm. none of her kind of desire, none of her kind of actions are represented after a certain point. But I get that. I'm not saying that's not valid. I'm saying I didn't read that at all beforehand. Not mm-hmm. like, you know. Having gone through The Phantom Menace, I know there's some things that are, you know, some people will read differently when it comes to racism.
You might just not pick up on stuff. Yeah.
But, It didn't read that way to me, but I'm not sensitive to it, and so that's interesting mm-hmm. to note.
Yeah, I feel it. You know, it doesn't necessarily read that way to me. Partially, as you said, she didn't signify as particularly Asian, but I think more to the point was when you have this mountain of misogyny of which this episode has been constructed on, like the racial implications are almost the least of the problems. You know, yeah. when you have, you know, you, sir, are from Vulcan, where women are logical. The only planet that could possibly be true on. You yeah. know?
Spanking like, and slapping and...
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, yeah. there's so
Taming
many...
of the Shrew itself is kind of misogynistic. Yeah. It's...
I was wondering about...
Yes, like, yes, it is.
Devil's Advocate, I was wondering... Because I was picking up on all that too, obviously. But I was like, okay, how would this be different if this was a bratty male ambassador that they had to take somewhere, who Kirk had to, for some reason... And I'm like, okay, well, it's kind of Charlie X a little bit. He pulled right. a lot of the stuff with Charlie X. There's a lot mm-hmm. of butt slapping in that one, too.
you got to
But again, it was a woman getting her butt slapped.
Right, exactly. Yeah, she was a stand-in butt. But yeah, and I don't know. I don't know what conclusion I came to, but I was trying to weigh that in my, okay, am I just reacting to this because it's a man like disciplining and belittling a woman? Is that like,
I mean,
does she deserve, is she, if, you know, is she, oh.
Look,
you are kind of like you were like Roy Schneider on the bridge in a Sorcerer right now. Yes. So, like, yeah. so does she deserve to get no?
Well,
wait a minute.
I think that's a 100% fair question, Tom.
Thank you, John.
Because just because she's a woman does not mean she can be the awful. Horrible
she is being horrible. She's being right. a horrible yeah. person, and she does. There's a job that Kirk needs to do. Like she needs to be prepared for this thing that she's going to do, and she's fighting it at every turn. Right. If she was like a 10-year-old, you wouldn't think of it. You'd be like, all right, stop it. You need to be disciplined. You need get it together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Know, but they also wrote an adult woman to be act like a 10-year-old brat, which is sort of
right.
problematic.
But I mean, yeah, go ahead.
It could, you know, yeah, it could easily have been a different, you know, I think it would be a very similar, other than the love tears, it would be a very similar story if it was, you know.
Oh, it'd be so much better if it was a man.
Oh, man. That's more yeah. of a, yeah.
Put those tears to the test.
But yeah, it is
Sounds
like.
Great. Oh, that's another thing we need to change about this episode.
They'll, I just got distracted by thinking about it. All right, we deepfake.
Let's see. Kirk. Kirk, yeah. Let's go for it.
We deepfake Louis Jordan into it.
I was thinking the same thing.
But we've seen Kirk act much more chauvinistic with less provocation. Then here he's yes. more kind of annoyed at the, it's more like, hey, this is my ship. Shut up. Like, just listen. Mm-hmm. And then she slaps him, which then just leads to a slap back. And it's not a,
she started it.
Yeah.
It's kind of a Sam and Diane slapping.
Mm. Right.
Right.
But that's the most delicious thing on the menu at Cheers. It's the Sam and Diane. The
open face.
But yeah.
I don't know what that means.
Sam and Diane? You've never had Sam and Diane? Oh, it's wonderful. Delicious. It's Alaskan. Only Alaskan Sam.
The farm stuff is not as good. But the kind of, I don't know, I did walk that line myself, wondering, I'm like, all right, because at some point it does, mainly, I think more so in dialogue than in action, is it kind of this kind of the chauvinistic, the sexist, misogynistic action. Because it is more just kind of like, hey, she's basically acting like a Commodore.
Right, yeah. If she was a Commodore trying to take over the ship, right. she would get slapped.
Drop that logical joke. Boy, you'd be going a long ways getting rid of some of the massage. That one really just don't.
Or if he had applied that to drop the women part of that logical joke or something. Mm-hmm. People on your planet are logical. That's the only place you can say that about. I'm dealing with this person who's a pain in my ass.
Yeah, and frame it as being an issue with someone who has too much power and no sense of responsibility, which is kind of under the surface.
Yeah.
But then instead they slap this gender thing on top of it, so you can't quite get to that thematic element. If we get rid of the gender part of it at all, don't mention that, and say this is about someone who has too much power and not enough responsibility or maturity, then there you are. That's your arc anyway. To me, that's her arc anyway. She does that's what they're really talking about, but then they have to go like women, right?
Right.
Anyway. Yeah, there are also like lines like, oh, I'll show her some strength, Petri. Like there's that kind of like women respond to, like masculine, like there's.
Right. But that gets him stabbed. So that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good moment because that gets him stabbed. And I that.
But I mean, the implication I got is sort of like he doesn't know how to be strong enough.
Right.
As I said before, I could use more Petri. I think he should have continued. They should have had more him kind of getting flustered Petri. And being like, see, like with a lot of stuff. And
I really wish Petri was played by. Why Paul Lind?
Paul Lind, yeah. That's true for pretty much every character in every show, though.
Yeah.
I was thinking about Dr. Smith.
Dr. Smith from Lost in Space would have been really good.
Yeah, that's not far
off. Why can't I think of that actor's name? People are real mad at me right now.
Yeah, because you're Dr. Smith. What else do you need to know?
Jonathan Harris?
Yes, that's it.
Very good.
All right. But the... Yeah, they I don't know. Could more... Less... Less misogyny, more Petri. Those are my notes.
There you go. That's our motto for today.
We can get behind that.
We got a costume change, which this I forgot at what point the first one is. Let me talk about costumes for a second with this, because we get a I think it's in the second or third one. I think it's the second one where we first clearly see. The triangle kind of on her head, which I watched this one with my kids. Maybe not. I wasn't expecting it to be kind of go into some of the places it did. I'm not sure if I would do that again.
But, I was actually wondering about that as I was watching the episode.
Yeah. But they she one of them was like, why does she have a triangle sticker on her head? I was like, I don't know. But then I thought, oh, it's a BIM mark from. So if you've seen the Apple. It's a BIM mark. She's obviously the BIM Corporation. Has,
And if you're listening to us, you've probably seen the Apple.
One would hope.
Yep. And if you haven't, see the Apple.
Well, wait until movie theaters are a thing again. And then the best way to see it is with a crowd, because it's a fantastic. It's totally a good midnight movie for that kind of a thing.
Mm.
But this... Elan is the, she's tied with somebody that we have seen and somebody we haven't yet seen for most costume changes. She's tied with Lenore from Conscience of the King, who had four costumes. And can you remember who the one that we'll meet later on is?
Was it Khan?
Yes. Tom Taylor, it is Khan.
Khan from 1996? Okay.
Khan.
I only know that because you mentioned this before a few episodes. Yeah. Probably with Lenore, yeah, that they had that strange connection.
So even though it's four costumes, probably still uses less fabric than most of Kirk's one costume.
And we can make a couple more dresses if you want to. We've got a lot of stuff left over.
It's a good, interesting looks throughout the costumes. There's no real reason given for her costume changes other than, I guess people would change clothes, but...
Do they?
But there is the sort of she goes down to sick bay and then comes up with a new dress, and it's the wedding dress, so there is the plot point to it, but it's still kind of ridiculous.
And maybe, so I can understand changing from your, like, you know, arrival, your travel outfit into, okay, here's my lounging around, here my, you know, my cruise outfit, my cruising moo-moo.
There is, I will allow, and I would hate to use, I hate the fact that I'm using episode one as any sort of reference point.
We've talked about it a couple of times now, so.
Yeah, but the appearance of regality, much like with Queen Amidala in Phantom Menace, is, you know, appearance is part of regality, and therefore it's almost an obligation to constantly be wearing something different.
Right.
That's my cheap reasoning, and I'm willing to stand by it.
I'm not complaining. It's interesting that it's basically like a short trip, and she wears four different outfits.
Yeah. I do kind of wish some of the outfits may have had a little more thought into them. They didn't quite fit correctly.
No.
They're just like weirdly baggy in spots and weirdly like... It was just a weird, like, oh, man, I really wish Star Trek had a better Taylor for this episode. It should have had Tom Taylor.
See? The show's got better Taylors.
I will say that her regality comes into question considerably when she's eating.
Oh, man.
She definitely has some like bad table manners, which, of course, are the point of the scene.
Right.
Or part of the point of the scene.
I think the point of the scene is that what she's eating is green space chicken.
Yeah.
chicken.
With, like, four legs or something, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's space chicken for you.
When I saw that, I was like, is she really going to take a bite of that? Like, and she did. I was like, oh, good for her. All right. Like, because whatever they...
Just food coloring, tasteless, you know.
I guess. I don't know. I've tried to put food coloring on some things, and it does. I don't know. Sometimes I'm not happy with the way it comes, but I don't know if I would have put it on chicken ever.
Maybe you should try it. Mm. Let us know.
Then lo and behold, we see that as we're getting chased by, you know, Klingons show up, and they were in league with. We get a little subplot of Amok Time almost. The Klingons were in league with Kryten. To sabotage this whole thing because he was in love with Elan, probably because he had felt her tears at some point or something like that.
That's not established, is it?
No, it's not, but it's totally.
Shouldn't it be?
If he's her main bodyguard, I'm sure he's...
Well, I would have liked to have known that. That would have made me feel a little bit... I didn't care about Kryten, what happened to him, what he was doing. I would have known that he was under the spell, that adds to the stakes with Kirk.
Right.
So, this is what happens to you. You end up turning yourself into a green light and disappearing eventually.
You don't want to be like Kryten, do you?
Yeah.
Getting that out would have been real nice.
Yeah.
This episode is sort of a cocktail shaker of a lot of other Star Trek episodes.
Yeah.
I was just thinking the same thing, Joe.
There's like a little bit of Journey to Babel. There's,
a lot.
You know, I mean, there's a Amok Time. I'd say that, you know, all the Klingon stuff has a little bit of Balance of Terror in it. And granted, it's a well that they would dive into for other episodes. But Balance of Terror for me is the spaceship battle episode.
It's funny because it's so counter in a way to Balance of Terror.
Yeah. No.
And that they decided not to write anything for the Klingons at all. He just simply goes, no terms, only surrender.
Pull over.
That's like all the lines. He's talking like a caveman.
And it uses the, you know, my first love is my ship stuff, which has been in, four episodes that we've covered so far? Uh-huh. Like, there's just a lot. This episode's a little bit of a hodgepodge, and by little bit, I mean it is a hodgepodge.
Pre-rip-off Next Generation, the Famke Janssen episode. How'd they do that?
I don't remember the Famke Janssen episode. Which one?
Oh, it's the exact same thing. It's like it's a woman who is being taken to this planet to marry a guy, and she falls in love with somebody who she shouldn't fall in love with.
Only which season?
Season three, I think.
Maybe.
It's like one of the early, really good episodes. It's a really good episode. And they think to actually encase her in a box. Like, they don't know what's in the box.
Yeah.
Because she's so dangerous. And it's not. And you don't have to touch her tears. You just simply look upon her.
Right. It's her thing that she, like, imprints on people and becomes, like, the woman
it's
whoever is with her needs her to be and stuff.
Sort of like the episode where Lloyd Braun from Seinfeld seduced Dana Troy. That's who he was. I mean,
you mean are you talking about Mayor Dinkins's like right hand man?
No, I'm talking about
that's what he is on Seinfeld. He's Mayor Dinkins's right hand man.
Yeah, but he is in, there's an episode where basically he is a diplomat or an ambassador or something like that. You know which episode I'm talking about?
Yeah, it's I was just making a joke about Lloyd Braun because I think he's such a funny character on Seinfeld.
You lost me. You can lose me with Columbo. You can lose me with Seinfeld. I'm all over the place.
Let's come up with all the shows we can lose Pete on and talk about them.
Yeah.
Including Next Generation.
So then Bob the cop came in and he said to Felix.
Then we figure out that, the Klingon, once Crichton zaps himself, the Klingons are going to attack, and then they're like, now we're dead because they're going to, if we go into warp, we blow up. Otherwise, they're going to just blow us out of the sky. But then they figure out, then Spock just suddenly is just like, wait a minute, hang on. There's dilithium crystals in the room.
His spider sense is tingling.
Yeah, which is brought in a way, like, I, it seems kind of out of nowhere, but it's also like, all right, the, her accepting her role in all this because of her interaction with Kirk leads to her putting on the necklace, which then leads to her being on the bridge and doing it. Like, I get it. I like that. It does seem a little bit like it took me a minute to be like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But
I have an actual legit question.
Yeah.
What actually happened to the dilithium crystals on the ship?
Did
they ever say the Crichton sabotaged it or something? Or I know he planted a bomb.
Yeah. He rigged a bomb into it, but also it got the thing got fused. Scotty says that at some point. Like something got fused and then basically all the crystals were shot.
I guess I can go along with that and assume that, it was some sort of sabotage. But I feel like I want a little more handholding in this episode for some reason. I don't want to have to do the work. I want to know why she's crying. Are the tears on purpose? Who did the dilithium crystals?
Well, I think we need to talk about warp speed in this episode a little bit. The concept of warp speed in this episode is extremely confusing to me.
Ain't that the truth?
My conception of warp speed is it gets you from one great distance to another great distance faster, yet the Klingons are behind them, apparently visible. They're apparently so close. They're far enough back that they're staying back and they're keeping a parallel course and all that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But they can see each other. But then the Klingons kick into warp 6 and then there's some maneuvering, warp 2 maneuvering later. I'm like, buddy, if you're in warp drive, that's not the thing. You don't want to do that while you're maneuvering or firing. It's like, I was really confused by all that. And then the funniest thing was when the Klingon ship comes in, they have that one effect shot where it's coming right at them. And it is like the Klingon helmsman drank way too much blood wine or something. Because it's going whoa! It's wobbling around drunken style. It's like, what is going on here? But all that stuff was really confusing to me. And I don't think it's the third season. I feel like they've got this stuff pretty established earlier, right?
If this first season, it would be like, all right, they don't know what the terminology is yet. But it's very... Yeah, it's slapdash all over the place with, I wrote they're headed for us at warp speed because they're just using impulse engines. Then they're headed for us at warp speed, which means they would be there in seconds. You know,
they would already have been there 10 times.
Is it possible that we just understand this better than anybody did back then, including the writers, because we've been through Next Generation and movies and everything and stuff?
No, and I think that's what I'm
saying. Not to mention everything that borrowed from it, like basically Star Wars, like basically any... I want to get to point A to point B. That's a billion miles, and we have
much
to do
more
it
advanced nerds.
But even this episode establishes the rules, the difference between impulse and warp drive.
They're
it's
not
a
using
short
warp.
Distance
they're going
situation.
Very slow. Yeah,
like it seems to me that warp would not be something that would be an aid one way or another in ship to ship combat. Which
absolutely not.
And the episode, and within the context of the episode, it seems that it is invaluable to ship combat, which makes no sense.
Yeah.
To me, it breaks its own rules within the episode. To me,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Weren't the weapons also affected though by the dilithium thing? Or am I making that up?
Yeah.
Okay, so they could have just had that. Like, oh, we can't fire back. We're sitting ducks.
Well,
then
why don't they escape? I think that's the question too. Like, why not just go somewhere else?
And earlier, they didn't have to say the Klingons are headed for us at warp 6. They could have just said they were running the parallel course.
Yeah.
Now they're closing in.
Yeah,
you don't have to tell me they're doing it at ludicrous speed, you know. It's just like, come on. I get it. All you have to do is tell me something changed. That's it.
I mean, if they go to warp, they're not going to be able to shoot us, so that's why they're not doing it. Like, that's
hooray, they've gone to warp 6.
Yeah.
See you later. They're long gone now, so yeah, it's just very bizarre, all this warp talk.
Yeah I had a question.
What of Lazarus?
That was my question.
We need to ask that regularly.
We've never really pinned down the answer
because there's never been an answer. Yeah,
I mean, we'll have to come back to it. At the end of this whole project, we'll understand.
That's the hope. So. That's the whole point of the show is that we'll know what of Lazarus by the end.
Are dilithium crystals not radioactive? Speaking of Lazarus, wasn't there a whole big deal about handling them in Alternative Factor? And haven't they in the past? Haven't it just been like, oh, here?
Yeah, you remember they were super dangerous to handle, but then you could just put them inside that little compartment in his UFO.
Yeah, a little
which was clearly not like guarded, like safeguarded in any way. But it's inconsistencies about all this stuff.
I built the bridge in my mind that in their raw form, they're basically inert.
Right.
And basically to get them to work, they need to be charged. And that's why Scotty was like, all right, these aren't.
Yeah, but
you know, these aren't shaved off and they're not like, you know, specialty cut, but it's what we got. So that's what we use. Like, I just kind of assume that, when you're mining for crystals, they're fine. You know, they're relatively inert. It's when they're charged that they become super radioactive.
We shouldn't use the alternative, even if it's contradicting the alternative factor. I think that this episode trumps the alternative. I'll say that was wrong first.
Right.
Yeah,
you're right.
Nothing else bears that up.
And I mean, the alternative factor contradicts the alternative factor. Like, look at all the weird mustaches and stuff on Lazarus.
That's the point of that episode.
And then
self-contradictory.
And then I thought, is this not equivalent to like throwing the crown jewels into your gas tank? Like, if you were like trying to escape and they're like, oh, wait, give me that necklace. We need to like,
I guess.
Would that fly? Like, if it was to save the Dolman.
I think if all the Muppets
Rudy
were
Ray
about
Moore.
To die, they'd throw the fabulous baseball diamond
exactly.
gas tank. Yes,
but and that's actually another contradiction. Like, she is regality incarnate, and yet, hey, what's that in your necklace? Oh, some worthless rocks.
Right.
Like, one of the things about the crown jewels is they're not worthless.
That's why she was resistant to putting them on, though, because that she thought they were worthless rocks. They were coming from, they were a gift from Troyes.
Why would Troyes, hey, here's a bunch of worthless rocks on your planet that we made a necklace of.
Well, because on her planet, maybe.
This episode's pretty, there's a lot of, it's a rocky road this episode.
As we've said for several episodes, it's like, wouldn't it hurt the writer's room to do a second pass?
Yeah.
Well, so that's another interesting thing about this one.
Ah, yes.
That this is the only episode in all of Star Trek, apparently, to be fully written and directed by the same person. Which surprised me when I read that. I was like, no, surely they... Oh, all right.
I won't call it Shirley then.
None of the big name writers you can think of ever directed episodes.
Yeah. Right.
I don't believe. So usually they kept that very separate.
And he, this is John Meredith Lucas who did it. And he's got a weird, interesting, like, involvement at this point, because he basically takes over from Gene Kuhn. And he is kind of running the show almost. He's still answering to a lot of people, but it's interesting. I wonder how much of it would have been different if it was, if this was run through somebody else, like if this was submitted, if this episode was, you know, produced in second season, how would it have gone?
Well, I mean, I think he's still answering to Fred Freiberger, though. And Fred Freiberger is the showrunner at this point.
Yeah. But
we all know that running it through the old Freiberger isn't really very helpful.
Right. Yeah, I was about to say, if I wanted to make up a name for like a Hollywood executive, Fred Freiberger would be the name I would make up.
Fred Freiberger.
It would be like, Freiberger, you know, Johnny Glitz is on the scene.
Yeah, everything's boffo to him, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Fred Hamsteamer.
But
one thing about...
In this part of the country, at this time of day...
One thing that we've been tracking, I think we always tend to talk about, and I think this is we're hitting the peak of this. They're real fast and loose with the mind meld now.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
He just basically
Kirk is just calling up for the old mind meld.
He doesn't have to do it. That's the whole thing. He's just like,
Well, but it's almost like it's
like he's ordering a milkshake. He's like, bring down one of them mind melds.
Oh, and a cup of coffee.
That super personal thing you almost wouldn't do back in like season one. Just come on, do that immediately.
Yeah, we just did, you know, the devil in the dark, where it was like, are you sure?
Yeah.
You don't want to do this, right? I mean, it really takes a toll. And now he's like calling him up and said, gonna need one of those.
And not to mention like Dagger of the Mind, which was this whole, you know, strap yourself in, it's mind meld time.
Yeah. Stand back. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this guy might have some information, and he's not gonna. Okay, and he says he's not gonna respond to physical torture.
Right.
So, first of all, big question. Federation, Starfleet people are just gonna torture people. Is that part of their regular routine?
Well, I think they're just noting that they wouldn't. There's no point.
It sounds to me like he's like, alternatively, we should then use this other thing. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. Think they were going to waterboard them, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, I just thought, like, man, he's being real casual about the mind meld.
It was
shocking.
I laughed out loud. It was so casual. It's like, just, you know,
need one of them there, get down mind meld thing.
There is a kind of thing, though, that's nice about, like, whoever, you know, John Meredith Lucas? Is that his name?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do kind of like, well, I read the Bible before I did the show. You know, I read the show Bible before I directed the episode. There is like, if you watch a lot of television, and we all have, and if you watch a lot of genre shows, like, the contradictions are just blatant, and things that are referenced are not referenced at all. Like, this superhero can walk through walls. Damn it, I'm trapped in a room with four walls. There's nothing I can do.
Right.
You know, and like, where I do sort of like the mind melds in there. Klingons are in there. You know, Dilithium crystals. There's enough Star Trek, nooks and crannies in this Star Trek episode that kind of make it like, for lack of a better way to phrase it, well, it's definitely an episode of Star Trek.
Right.
Or a lot of episodes of Star Trek.
Yes.
It all collided with each other.
It's like a transporter accident of Star Trek episodes. Mm.
It's a pink poodle with a horn.
Yep.
Well, so there's a lot. Let me see if I had some outside notes. At the very end of it, there's two things from the very end of it. I really do like the resolution of, you know, it's this kind of almost like a fake out of like, you know, McCoy is just like, hey, I got the antidote. And they're like, no need. Like,
the antidote all along.
Yeah. Well, it's like a, you know. It's playing on that kind of like that Star Trekism of like, hey, everything's going to go back to normal at the end. But then, you know, it's a little bit like, oh, he just got it. He's just not going to look at her for a while because he's got the ship. And-
but he's still got to take the antidote, right?
I feel like, yeah, that ending actually, I thought was really stupid. I thought it didn't. I was.
Yeah, Pete.
Because it's, no. I mean, it's built up as less like, oh, he's under her spell. It's like a thing. It's a physical, medical thing that he's under her spell. And, well, you know, I got a job, though. I got a job and I got a ship.
It's the ship, Tom. You don't understand.
I know. I mean, I get it. I appreciate the idea of it, I guess. It's just like the way it happens with zero, I don't know, effort or anything. Like Kirk's like not even listening to them. He's like, no, I got a job, whatever.
Well, you know where we could where we could find out whether or not this antidote took is
there's a book.
It's in the Star Trek novel Firestorm by L.A. Graff.
I was hoping somebody would have done some research on at least a plot synopsis. Has somebody, Pete?
Well, let me tell you, the cover announces boldly, a giant volcano holds a deadly secret.
It's called lava.
Yeah. There's a mining operation.
It's called caramel.
On I don't know, back to the same two planets, but the Dolmen claims another planet, and that she's like, all right, there's been almost like Star Trek VI. Like there's a mining accident thing, but then she's like, all right, well now this is basically like, hey, I'm claiming this. I need all the dilithium. And then the Enterprise is called in to be like, well, no, we got to work this out because you're putting people in danger. And we'll see if, I don't know. Tough to, it doesn't mention whether or not Kirk is healed from his earlier, if the tear still holds an effect. But
I would almost buy it more if it was like, if you know, Spock points out, oh, he's got his job, he's got his first love, whatever, you know, if he had like some like look, like side glance from Kirk, like, I'm dying, you know, I'm putting the bravest face I can on it, I'm just going to stick to my work, do anything I can to forget her, I love her so much, I'm never going to be with her.
If they had a, let's get the hell out of here, like, what is the, I'm drawing a blank, there was another episode, was it the Conscience of the King?
There
where,
is another
like,
one.
It kind of, where it kind of ends with like Kirk being like, oh, I miss my boobie.
Yeah, there's sort of like McCoy tells him that she's going to be in a loony bin, and he was like, let's go.
Yeah, he was excited about that. He's like, oh, great, I don't have to worry about that.
But there is one that ends on that kind of somber, another love lost note, besides City on the Edge Forever.
And, well, there's Gamesters of Triskelion, which is... No,
one that we've already done, not one that's coming up.
That's a,
oh, and even Dagger of the Mind, like... Dagger of the Mind, he's brainwashed into being completely in love with John's girlfriend Godfather 2.
Oh, yeah. That's
and, right. Yeah, but at the end of that, he's kind of like...
never mind.
Like, I forget if they even address it. Like, I thought this part of that episode in this episode.
I kind of remember the end of Dagger of the Mind was a sort of like, well, we'll be having our fun now. Like,
oh.
Maybe. Well, right. I mean, in the last act of the episode, it's sort of like, well, now I have feelings for you. It's not just a joke. Now I don't even remember. Who knows? I've watched a lot of Star Trek in the last couple
All
of months.
All I know is I still have feelings for her.
Mm-hmm. See? You're under the spell.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Old Helen Noel.
Well.
Yeah.
But then also at the end, the very end, when Kirk is just kind of like, you know, he's soaking himself in his work to get his mind off of his tear fraught love. There's a moment, speaking of being racist and Asians, there's a moment where he's like, Mr. Sulu, prepare to take us out of orbit. And he hands the clipboard to another guy who is Asian, but not Mr. Sulu. And I was like, did he just like, is everybody like, that's not Sulu. Like,
oh my Jim. God, really? I missed but, that.
Yeah, well, he seemed like totally, a page yeoman.
He's a yeoman, and then Sulu is actually sitting at the console. There's a minute there where I was just like, oh, my God, did they, like...
And it's not even Vic Toyota, the George Takei lookalike.
No, it's some other random yeoman.
Oh, my God.
who, like, looks enough like, you know, it's like, oh, he's got, you know, like, kind of... Asian enough, like Asian in Starfleet looks to that point, right. Where he's got a very similar hairstyle to Sulu and of similar build. He's kind of slight, but he's wearing like a blue shirt and he's like, oh,
no one will notice.
Did he? Yeah. No one's going to know.
It's like when they replaced her with that white woman. Like, no, no one's going to notice.
Yeah. And I forgot, I'm trying to get, he's not listed here in anything. So we don't know who that is, I don't think.
Oh, wow. That's impossible.
But we do have Watson. Watson mm-hmm. is the red shirt who gets killed in this episode.
Face grabbed.
By Crichton. Yeah. He's just kind of gets like...
I have face
He's the one that tells her... Like, that's talking to her, basically giving the tour of the engineering section, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And then I think so.
And I thought that... I thought there was going to be a moment there. This is another thing. I really didn't care for the generic, we're only interested in how it fights, only right. interested in battle. When the conflict that was sitting there right under their nose was, he just spilled the beans about the fact that they're not going warp speed. Why yep. didn't she get mad about that? That would be right. more so. I thought for sure she was going to be like, Captain, why are we not going full speed to the planet? Or although, something could have been a bored. Better source of conflict than... I want to know how it fights.
I mean, she doesn't want to do this any more than, you know, she's not interested in getting there and getting married. So maybe she wants to delay mm-hmm. it as well.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't right, she say, she's like, oh, with this ship, I could destroy those bozos and get on with my life?
I can't remember. All that happens is Scotty gets offended. Without engines, it can't fight, you know, right. and all that stuff. I was just like,
minions.
create a conflict within this scene that has something to do with the episode. That's all I'm asking.
Yeah. See, it was
right there. They could have done something with it. She's like, why are we going slow? Because the reason they're going slow is to trick her into being
to make you not act like a maniac.
Yeah,
like,
that's so what we're doing. It's right there, you know. Anyway,
but I find those lapses of, you know, kind of like by the numbers, you know, plot points, I find those really soothing often. I'm like, oh, good. They didn't mm-hmm. go for the thing that would make sense to do at this point.
Oh, I hate that. To me, I'm like okay. it goes against everything. I'm like, oh, that's clearly the second draft would have had that.
I know, but that's why I find it refreshing, because I'm like, oh, good.
I know. I don't have good stories.
I mean, I see both of your points, and I've mentioned several times throughout the course of this podcast so far that we need to, that, you know, a second draft wouldn't have hurt, but at the same time, like, there's a charm to, like, all the asides that I just adore. Like, I can't, like, okay, let's give Scotty, like, you know, let's get Scotty's feathers ruffled because somebody said that engineers are basically slave labor.
Right.
I mean, look, I'll just make the point. Of course, that's our baseline feeling about Star Trek. Like, we love Star Trek. That's why we're doing a show. Just kind of like we talked about with Devo. We like Devo across the board, but we're talking about these shows individually to hold it to a different standard and to discuss what could have been or what couldn't have been. And to me, that just struck me almost like, man, that was right there. It's right within your grasp to have a scene that connects to the rest of the episode and you didn't do it.
Yeah.
But
so I'm just saying, again, I also like
this. She has no interest in getting there right away. She doesn't want to do this. Mm-hmm.
What I'm doing is entirely talking about the craft of writing here. I'm just saying, when you sit down to write a scene like this, if you write this scene and I hand it to you and you read it, you go, dude, I don't know what this scene's about. Like, what does this have to do with the rest of the show? That's what I'm doing, which we're now 60 years on from this, and we enjoy Star Trek for all kinds of reasons. It's not certainly not pitch perfect scripting of episodes.
Right.
So
that's
just, I'm just giving us something to talk about. That's all.
You know, speaking of things that may not have made a lot of sense or worked in, did you guys happen to catch in your research how one scene was cut featuring Spock in the Starfleet atrium playing the Vulcan harp that was being buzzed into Uhura's room? Mm-hmm. Apparently there's a still of it. Like, oh, wow. Oh man, I wish that was there.
Yeah. Yeah. The arboretum.
Take out the fight with the security. Yeah. Take out this fight of the security guard and Crichton and give me Spock jamming.
Wait, what we were talking about Watson. I derailed it completely. You were starting to talk about him. What kills Watson again?
Oh,
he breaks his neck.
He just touches his face, though. Yeah. He doesn't do anything violent to him.
Needless to say,
I'm glad we all have a note about that. It's not just my weird hand-to-hand combat stuff that I enjoy
watching.
A weird
cell, but believe me, his neck is broken. He's killed.
You don't know about the famous
red shirt, by the way, on the show.
Okay. 14th red shirt. Very good, Tom. Yeah. Thank you.
So you guys don't know about the famous Elysian face touch?
Yeah.
Like that immediately breaks her neck?
See, I almost want that. I'm almost if you're not going to have him break his neck, just tell me that they can do stuff like that. I don't know.
Yeah.
It was just funny. This is one of those points where you laugh a little bit when it's supposed to be a God, this guy just died, and this is a moment where the stakes are raised. He killed somebody. He's got control of engineering, and he's doing this. Yet I'm laughing because it was so ridiculous how he killed him. Just like touched his face. Dead. Right.
Well, that the actor. My note for Watson was that the actor who plays him, we will see again. We won't for quite a while. Production wise, he was seen again not too far from here, because he plays Tongo Rad in the episode The Way to Eden.
Oh, nice.
I gotta fix my bones, McCoy.
Victor Brandt. There you go. That's his name, the actor. Let's see. How close to these were, I don't know, June? A lot of Troyes he filmed in June, and Way to Eden he filmed in November. So it wasn't like they just brought him in for like a week and he did too. It was like, he's one of, he totally looks like, Chris Radke in a purple fright wig with a bunch of grapes painted on his face in The Way to Eden.
I know
we'll see.
Jeez, really wish you could make references that were specific.
If you're listening to this show, hopefully you know who Chris Radke is.
Yeah, most of the people listening to the show probably know who he is, yeah.
I wonder if Chris Radke listens to the show. He should. No. Now he's referenced.
He doesn't like Star Trek.
No, this show's garbage, man.
Does he not like Star Trek?
I don't think so.
That's weird.
Really? Yeah. He's friends with a lot of people who do, but...
thinks Marvel is way better than Star Wars, so we're not...
I might
really
too.
Well, Marvel as an entity, but he really loves Star Wars. So him loving Star Wars, Marvel more than Star Wars, it's really, it's like I like scotch more than whiskey. I mean,
here's another interesting note that during the filming of this episode, RFK was shot.
Yes,
and not on set. But
just grabbed his face.
Era, I want to see a Klingon.
Right.
Rosie Greer played. Sorry, I'm just naming people that were present.
We're still laughing about a guy's death. Look at us. We're ghouls.
Yes, it's true.
But yeah, apparently it was Frances Noyan was very broken up about it, and funneled some of that into her acting. Apparently, her frustration with the world.
Is that the excuse?
Yeah.
I mean, and here's my thing. Like, as a young woman, was a beautiful woman. I do not argue that. She definitely has presence. I don't know if I really liked what one could generously call acting about her. Well, and it's certainly passable. Don't get me wrong. It's not like... I don't know. It's not like Conrad Brooks or something, but it is just sort of, but like, there is a kind of like, there is a bit of a flat/wooden delivery to a lot of her dialogue.
Well, let's bring it back once more to The Phantom Menace, where it's, in that same vein where it's like, she's got this kind of, weird alien regality. That's the woodenness.
Yeah, fair.
Well, I thought she did a great job myself.
I mean,
when she gets angry, she totally flips and becomes totally different.
I believe that her character changes throughout. I don't know. I see a lot of good acting in it.
Yeah.
She's the
certain
best part. And I think she actually elevates Shatner in their scenes.
Certain performances just affect people differently, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, such is the case. It seems like we're a little bit all over the place.
much like this episode.
Yep. Perfectly appropriate.
let's figure out how we feel about it. I have no idea where to put this in my weird compartmentalizing. I
gotta help you, but I don't understand it.
It's command. It's gotta be command.
Kind of.
Like... it's all about that responsibility, and it's all about leadership. And then in the end, it's literally the solution to the whole problem is the ship. Commanding the ship is the...
and emotional chutzpah.
Hey, wait, understand Pete's classification system? It only took 20-some episodes.
It is. I was also like... no, you're right. It's got to be command. Because that really, like, the only person who does anything interesting is Kirk, besides... Elan, obviously, and it's all about his his. Not only is he maintaining control command on his ship, but then also just kind of he's the one. It's his arc. So yes, it's a command episode. Very good. Thank you, John.
Nice job, Engel.
Thanks.
But then how do we feel about
like the
it?
The world has opened for me now. Third
His
eye.
His eyes are now open.
I thought that was a BIM mark.
What's yeah, it might be a BIM mark. Who knows?
But how do we feel about it? What do we let's put some letters on it. It does seem like we're all over the place. I feel like I'm gonna be higher than some of you guys on this, but it's tough to tell. I don't know. Sometimes your you know, the stuff that we nitpick, what I think is going to be a huge problem for you guys, ends up not taking that much off the grade.
Mm-hmm. I have no idea how to grade this one, honestly.
I'll start. I'll give it a C+. There's no way I'm putting this in the B's, but I think it's strong enough with the character arcs. The two primary character arcs, the central relationship is pretty good. Otherwise, if that wouldn't have worked, this would have been a disastrous episode. The Klingon stuff is clumsy. The dilithium stuff is clumsy. Like I said, I think it takes them too long to get out of the gate with the story. But I like her, and I like them together, and I like that comes to an interesting conclusion. I think we've talked about this multiple. I love that Kirk is so in love with the Enterprise. I think that's one of my favorite things about Kirk. So having that be the solution really works for me. But I couldn't possibly put it into any sort of grading where it could be on a list. So I'm going to go C+.
I might just give it a good old-fashioned C. Because I haven't talked through some of my confusions about this, but I still am not convinced it was there on the screen as I was watching it. And I don't know what else to say about it. It's fine. It's inoffensive. But yeah, there's no way it should be on the B list or anything. Mm-hmm. It's fine. It's a fine episode of Star Trek that took me by surprise in the late 90s after years of loving Star Trek. I will say I liked it more this time than I remembered liking it. I remembered it being a lot more dismissible, which, I mean, I guess a C is kind of dismissible, but I enjoyed it more than I expected to this time, but it's still just a C.
I'm kind of torn between a B- and a C+. I think I'm going to go for the C+, because part of what I enjoy about this episode is so much the camp factor. Mm-hmm. And camp starts with the letter C.
That's true.
But I mean, like, when I can't argue with anybody's problems with the episode in any realistic way, I can just say, but bright colors.
Right. Look at that food.
Look at, you know, it's green chicken. Also,
green chicken.
Did I blank out here? Did we discuss that this episode is called A Lane of Troyes? Like, that's the silliest thing imagine. Like, you might as well have in parentheses afterwards. Get it?
Yeah. Yeah. That is a little bit. Yeah.
Like, why didn't they name it after Taming of the Shrew? Like, it's shocking. If it was season one and two, it definitely would have been a play on that somehow. A line from Taming of the Shrew or something would have been the title.
Well, right. It is, you know, Helena Troy was, you know, her marriage was basically set to ensure peace. So there's a logic to it, but it's kind of like, you know, I don't know, what you might as well have William Space Spear, like, or Shakespeare, whatever, like
it's a Jetsons.
Yeah, that's what I'd say. It's a Jetsons episode kind of title. So I guess I'm going to go with C+, because I love it for the reasons why most people would dismiss it. And I can't put it in the B's because it is so politically incorrect. Like, you know, it's just like, I cannot help but notice how reductive this episode is in regard to, oh, let's just say women. But you can throw a lot of other things in there, too.
I mean, that's Star Trek, though.
But there are ones that are better than others.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, pad myself before I take this fall, but that I think it's not. I think she is, you know, she has kind of the most, not the most agency, but she is in control of a lot of what's going on up until the end, where she's just kind of like, I want to die with you. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
Pete, what you're saying, and I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth, broads are ditzy.
No, I
quote Pete Bonavita. Gotcha.
I was by a lot of I was pleasantly surprised by a lot of things in this episode. I also hadn't seen it in forever, and I was like, oh yeah, well, I forgot. I would have been dismissive of this one. The fact that it surprised me on multiple levels, I was like, oh, that gave me a general kind of positive feeling about it. And I might have gone, I don't know, I all over the place. I think talking to you guys is kind of tamping my excitement a little bit about it, because I'm like, aww, oh yeah, that's true, huh? But I think I still might go just a B, because I'm tempted to go B plus.
Wow.
Because I'm looking at the other ones that I gave a B plus. I'm like, Bread and Circuses, Cloudminders. Yeah, I like it. Kind of like those.
Bread and Circuses. I don't remember anybody giving that a good grade.
Bread and Circuses were almost made the B list, except for Joe gave it a C plus.
Really? Mm. I don't even remember.
I'm Mr. Negative.
Yeah. But yeah, I would almost go at B plus on this, because I really did. I was like, oh, I was like, I'm not riveted, but I was totally like into it, because I was like, I had no idea what was going to happen next, because it had been forever since I had seen it, and it wasn't playing by those kind of trope rules. And sure, there are things, you know, but there are things by modern standards that you know were not acceptable then and are not acceptable now, but we call them out more now. Mm. But again, that's in a lot of Star Trek, and I think this one, she does have kind of a strong, you know, she has agency and an arc, so that's I don't know, that's better than it could have been by far.
Fair enough.
So I'm just going to land on a flat B instead of okay. I don't know.
Flat.
Press the wrong key and we'll all be flat Bs.
Yeah, exactly. As far as I can recall, they do not say Elan of Troyes in the...
No, because she's not of Troyes.
Right.
Yet.
She's destined right. to
well,
be.
Well, they don't have to. Because
like, we're taking you on a trip so you can become Elan of Troyes. Like,
yes, they don't say it in the episode. They don't have to, because it's the title, and Star Trek does have title cards for all of their episodes.
Yeah, right. Well, true. We're tracking.
Well, they do say the title in Star Trek episodes sometimes.
I know. True. Right now, so far, it's
in
been
this
about
city
half and half,
on the edge of forever.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. A little bit. Fewer than half of the episodes have had the title in
it's
them.
It's like 40% on the Leo scale, the Leonardo DiCaprio pointing scale.
Oh, I wasn't scrolling.
Somebody should we should make a like a dial that is his finger. And it goes, anyway, right. I'm just brainstorming dumb ideas right now.
Dumb.
Well, we are.
We should just
this. We didn't say it at the top of the show. This is our first E episode.
I am.
E for episode. We finished the D's. We're on the E's. Elan of Troyes came first. And the next one is exactly what I was talking about when I said, oh, this could have easily just been one of those third season episodes that all get lumped together and I have no idea which is which. It's The Empath.
Mm.
Oh,
now,
oh boy.
Once listed as DeForest Kelly's favorite episode.
Oh, well, don't spoil it.
but will it be ours?
So it's one of those ones that we don't, you know, I have no idea. It could be one of many things. I'm like, wait, is this that one or that one or that one? So we'll find out which one it is. Mm. In the meantime, be sure to follow us on Twitter at ABCDTOS. Find us on Facebook in the ABCDTOS Briefing room. Woo! And abcdtos.com. Rate, review, subscribe on all your favorite things wherever you get the podcast. And hopefully, abcdtos.com/Patreon will take you to our Patreon page where you can get our, right now we're doing monthly reviews of the, review is a strong word, but we're doing monthly episodes loosely Ramblings. Centered around animated series episodes.
Very loosely.
Accurate way to describe them.
And a low monthly donation will get you that access, and we're always open to ideas of what else to do over there. So join us, and then hopefully you'll join us again here next week for a brand new episode of ABCDTOS. Yippee! Now's the time where somebody says something funny in addition that I could toss.
Yeah.
Off.
I said pew pew. Well,
I know, but that's always
duty.
There we go.
Green chicken for me.